temperate class we have. This is okay. And that's good because I have media to show you, and so I'll have to kind of close it up later on. If you can hear me and back okay, if not, turn off the fans and then turn them back on when we start sitting. I'm going to turn this one off right now and I'll turn it back on when we start sitting. Okay. So, first thing. If you haven't been signing in on the sign-in sheet, please remember to do that at some point. Weekly would be good. And if you've not signed in previous weeks, check the weeks that you've been here so that it's accurate. Okay? People who are getting CEUs, please make sure to do your sign-in each week. See, if we're starting on time, then what will happen is people will actually get here on time. So that's, because I realize people are going to be wondering. Okay, so first, Mind and Supermind is almost sold out. It's in this room on Monday, October 12th, and it's almost full. So if you want to hear Peter Nelson, get tickets now. I can't guarantee because we've not heard him. I just talked to him on the phone and read parts of his book. But I think probably he's going to be remarkable. I mean, he's really smart guy talking about an ability he's had since he was a small child, and he's kind of not fuzzy-headed at all. So he's going to talk about how this could possibly fit with science. He's also going to talk about what it's like to have this ability. Ability to see people's fields and therefore diagnose them if he chooses to. So if anybody's going to make a credible noise about it, he is. Before we sit, let me explain two seemingly contradictory things about mindfulness. First, for many of us, the primary value of mindfulness is that we can relax. We can release the stress that we hold. And it's a very kind of focused way to do that. So for many of us, what we're doing is we're finding tension and allowing it to release. We're breathing and opening up. We're softening. And we're kind of letting go of the world. If you focus only on your breathing and relax and ignore everything else, that's a concentration meditation. That is focused on one thing to the exclusion of everything else. And what that does is it takes you away from your life circumstances, and that can be a blessed relief. So there are times when all I want is to let go and become semi-conscious and release tension. And I don't go any further than that. That's what my system needs at that moment. That's a perfectly good use of mindfulness. And again, what you do is you just keep coming back to the breathing over and over and over again and softening and opening on every level. And that's when I guide you. That's how we start. We start by focusing on the breathing and letting go and softening and opening, and then I go through a progressive relaxation of the body, letting go, softening and opening. So at that point, you're more relaxed than you were, okay, and more open than you were. Very good.
Do you think that counting numbers mentally as you're breathing is part of the process?
It can be. I mean, in some traditional Zen. Some traditional Zen sects say to do that, to focus on the breathing, and to focus on numbers as you're... So if that feels good to you, or if a mantra, which is another way to enjoin your thoughts, if you count, you can't be thinking about other things. If you're doing a mantra, you can't be thinking about other things, supposedly. So some people like that. I don't, because it's mental agitation. Yeah. I want quiet, but...
But I'm thinking about the 4-7 combination of breathing.
Okay, no, pranayama is different. Okay, pranayama you can do after, either initially or after you've done a little bit of just mindfulness, you can adjust your breathing. If you know how to do 4-7-8 or square breathing, you can do that, and that makes a difference in the activation of the system. But in general, I don't tell people to do that because they get into trying to fix themselves again. So it creates more tension. So you can play with that. But the strict mindfulness instruction is let the head quiet completely, if it will, or at least don't battle with it. So you can choose whether or not you like to count the breath. So first benefit of mindfulness is a letting go of tension, a release, an opening, an allowing of healing to happen. And again, that may be all you want from mindfulness, or it may be all you want from mindfulness on a given day. Second benefit, however, is after you have focused on the breathing, let your attention quiet down, let your body release, then you open your attention so that you're aware of whatever is happening as it's happening. So you become more aware of your internal and external environment, but you don't get caught up in it. You're not identified with it. You've taken a step back by going through the breathing, and now you have a witnessing perspective. That is, you're more able to notice the entire range of your experience, inner and outer, than you were when you were fixated on one thing or lost in thought. So now you're more aware, but you're less caught up. So this witnessing perspective is really valuable, especially when things aren't okay in your inner and or outer world. If you have the witnessing perspective, you know what's happening, you can deal maximally well with it, but you're not ruled by it, you're not constrained by it. So to establish this witnessing perspective, you, after a letting go or relaxation, you remain open and relaxed, but you sharpen your attention so that you are aware of whatever thoughts are happening, feelings are happening, sensations are happening within your body or around you. So you become more perceptive. And sometimes that's what I want to do, because that's the real power of mindfulness, is that establishing of that greater non-caught-up awareness, non-judgmental in the moment, but extremely accurate awareness. However, sometimes I'm too fuzzy-headed to do that, and I just want to breathe and let go. Other times, I the only urging I give myself is, hey, pay attention. You know, really, how much are you missing? How much is going on in your emotional life, in your mental life, in your body, and around you? Are you missing at this point? And, of course, I'm missing most of it, because we take in so much more information than we're aware of. But what I'm trying to do is expand the field of awareness to take in more and more. This makes sense. There's two different things. One is the relaxing and letting go, and the getting away from all the trouble. And the other is, as you establish that relaxed, open perspective, then tuning back in. So you open the awareness around the breathing to include everything. So you're not trying to change anything, but you're not caught up. And when you get caught up, when you get narrowed onto something, you come back to the breathing and you open up. So we're doing quite a bit here. We're sitting here doing nothing. We're doing quite a bit of nothing. So any question before we sit? Pethel.
I like the analogy of you're watching the clouds flow by, but you're not caught up in it.
Yeah,
you can notice.
The various metaphors that you hear all around the world are this is the sky, this is the weather. Don't deny the weather, notice the weather, but the sky is bigger than the weather. The weather is just stuff coming and going. Another way to look at this is you're in the audience and this is the me show on stage. Don't get on stage. Stay in the audience. Okay? Let the me show do what it's going to do. If it's a tragedy, it'll change into a comedy. If it's a comedy, it'll change into a tragedy. Just kind of let it do what it's going to do. So you become more self-aware but less self-involved. Less governed by your personality patterns in your body, and more identified with a larger sense of being. And of course, that's the third aspect that I haven't really talked much about. But the question is, if you're not your thoughts, your feelings, and your body, who are you? And if you pay attention, if you've done both these other operations, and you want to pay attention to attention itself, that's the portal to enlightenment. Where is this coming from? What are the properties of this attention that has no properties? Where do I come in? Do I construct myself? Am I there to begin with? You know, what part of this attention is personal? What part of it is transpersonal? A few little things to pay attention to if you've mastered these other two. All right, so here we go. I will guide you to about the first... I'll be briefer each time with the guidance. I'll guide you through maybe 5 or 7 minutes, if that. And then I'll give you probably 7 minutes or so to sit by yourself and do whatever it is that you choose to not do. So. Is that okay, folks, with the fan? Okay, good. All right, good. Well, a little technical difficulty here. Hang on, folks.
See if I can get this to work. Nicely.
Okay, so sit upright. But not rigidly. Both feet on the floor is best. Make sure that you can breathe, so loosen any article of clothing that is restricting your breathing or causing you any distress. Either look down with your eyes open or close your eyes. And let yourself relax. Just invite relaxation. You don't have to make it happen. You just allow it to happen. Feel your breathing. Just notice your breathing. You will notice that the front of your body rises and falls gently with your breathing. Just let that happen. Let your belly be soft so that it can move. Your chest will move slightly also. In fact, the entire front of your body opens and closes, rises and falls with breathing. If we were very, very sensitive, we could feel our neck and head come up and down, arms and hands, legs and feet turn out and in very slightly with each breath. The back of the body participates also. You can probably feel your back open a little bit with the in-breath and close a little with the out-breath. Rise and fall. So you just rest your attention on your breathing and notice the participation of your whole body in your breathing. Anything else that you notice is fine. Don't try to get rid of anything or get away from anything. Just include whatever is happening in your meditation. But focus primarily. Keep returning attention to the breathing process. I have heard it said that a really sensitive meditator can tell one breath from another. I have never quite gotten that sensitive. But do you pay attention to the subtleties of the breathing? Include whatever else is happening in your awareness, but keep returning attention primarily to the breathing. Let everything soften and open. So pay attention now to your face and your head. Let your face and the sides, back, and top of your head soften and open. If there's any tension held in your face, usually we hold an expression on our face, let that expression kind of melt away. So your face becomes very soft and gentle. All the lines leave it, and it becomes very smooth. And open. Your eyes are not held closed tightly, they're just gently closed. All the muscles around the eyes can relax and release tension. Mouth and jaw soft. Any tension releases itself. So the mouth is either gently closed or one evenly slightly open. As the face relaxes, also the sides of the head, the back of the head, the top of the head relax. Soften. Open. It's almost as though your head isn't even there anymore. And a breeze could go right through where your solid head used to be. Keep coming back to the breathing with your attention when it leaves. So you're letting your face and head soften and open ever more completely. And you're just feeling your gentle breathing. Don't try to change the breathing, it will adjust itself. Pay special attention to your neck and shoulders, arms and hands. Let your neck and shoulders, arms and hands soften and open. Letting the tension stored in those areas release itself. Pay special attention also now to your torso. So as your neck and shoulders, arms and hands continue to soften and open, let your torso move similarly. Feel your back release. Feel the sides of your body release. Feel the front of your body release. Feel the internal organs of your body release excess tension so they function easily, smoothly, in a relaxed fashion. It's almost as though your arms, hands, neck, shoulders, and torso are disappearing. It's like a breeze could blow right through where your upper body used to be. And of course, you can feel your gentle breathing just happening naturally. If you get distracted, just gently come back to your breathing. There's no problem. Just breathe, soften, and open. Feel your lower body now, lower back, pelvis, legs and feet. If your body needs to adjust its posture just slightly to let go of tension, you can let it do so. So your lower back and pelvis, legs and feet are softening and opening, releasing any tension you're holding. It's almost as though your lower body is disappearing. It's like a breeze could blow right through where your lower body used to be. Can you just feel your gentle breathing? Your body continues to soften and open so that it kind of seems to disappear ever more completely. And there's just breathing and open awareness. Let your mind be completely open now, so there's no boundary to your mind, there's no edge to it. Your mind is just open in all directions to infinity. So thoughts can come and go with no resistance. They can just move right through easily. You just notice them, but you don't get involved with them. They just move through the spaciousness, the openness of your mind. Feelings can come and go completely as you open your body completely. So as the body opens ever more fully, so that it has no boundary, no border, no edge, so that it's open in all directions to infinity, feelings can flow easily through without any resistance. Similarly, sensations can flow through this openness with no resistance. You're just breathing and open awareness. Whatever happens can be noticed without taking away attention from the whole open field of attention. So whatever happens just moves through this open field of attention. And your job is just to keep returning attention to the breathing, softening and opening at every level, and noticing whatever occurs without getting absorbed. So you keep returning attention to your breathing, softening and opening, and noticing whatever occurs. I'll ring the bell in about 7 minutes.
If you get the idea that if you sat for a little longer, you could probably open a little more and become a little more peaceful and then a little more discerning, you're probably right. This is called practice. Each session is practice in becoming more aware in the ways that we have talked about. So instead of criticizing, if you criticize yourself when you go, oh, I did this wrong, or I was asleep, or I, you know, just notice those criticisms. Those are part of the process of becoming aware of how you generally think. Okay, so is there one question maybe on the mindfulness, and then I need to ask you a question. But is there anything you want to know right now that I could answer efficiently?
Say what it is that's left of you when there's no thoughts, feeling, or sensation.
Satchitananda. Okay, so Robert says, what's left when there's no thoughts, feelings, or sensations? And I somewhat glibly, but somewhat not glibly, said Satchitananda, which is infinite being, infinite awareness, infinite peace. But that's not my, that's what I have been instructed. My own experience is a little less focused than that. Okay. With regard to the syllabus that some of us are following, I want to talk a tiny bit, maybe one or two comments, about making social connection, which was the assignment for the week, and then talk about the assignment for next week, the suggested exercise. So is there a... I realize that making social connection one is kind of hard to talk about, but is there a person or two who would like to report on making a social connection this week that they would otherwise not have made, and the result of that? Does anybody have any input on that? Does anybody want to say anything about having done that exercise for the week? Mary, okay.
You go about like this.
Well, I gave my brother a phone call, and I normally avoid that because he likes to tease me and get me going, you know, politically and things like that. And so it was very uncomfortable, so I just have ignored him. So I gave him a call, and he wasn't home, but he said he called me back later, and there was something different in our connection this time. It was just very heartfelt, very in the moment, very supportive of each other, and there wasn't one reference to politics or anything like that. It was just a very, I don't know, it was a healing experience for me, so I'm glad that I did it.
So, you know, what Mary said, what Mary's experience points to is the fact that, you know, you can't heal anything if you don't make the attempt, not that it always is going to work. But maybe because of the spirit in which you did it, somehow that influenced the spirit in which the connection came back. Okay, maybe one more person reporting. Does anybody want to report? If not, we'll move on. Okay, so if you didn't do this exercise, now next week we're going to talk at greater length about the exercise. But if you didn't do the make social connection exercise, you still have that suggestion, which is make a social connection you wouldn't ordinarily make, and then kind of see if that was what happens with that. What's underneath this is the finding in psychology in general, and positive psychology in specific, that happier people have more social connection. Whether it's that happiness leads you to be more socially outgoing, or whether it's that more connection makes you happier, I think both are true. There is a very powerful tie between the amount of significant social connection a person has and how happy that person is. also how well physically that person is. That is, there's a lot of, they look at, I don't know if I'll get this exactly right, but they look at, I think they infected dental students with some kind of, volunteer dental students with some kind of virus. Then they saw who got sick and who didn't. And the ones with more social connection, you would have thought would get sicker, but they actually didn't get sick, and the ones with less social connection actually did get sick. And there's a lot of research that shows that people with a stronger social support system do better both mentally and physically. So the idea is get in the habit of making connection. It seems to be personally helpful and helpful to the people you connect to.
When I had my brain aneurysm, someone put a gun. When I was in ICU and I had my brain aneurysm, someone put a guest book in my room. I was totally clueless who I was, where I was. I didn't know anything. And I later, my kids gave me that book. And many people came and they said, I know you can't hear me, I love you, and I go, no wonder I got better. There was just, I was surrounded in love. But at the time, I had no clue, didn't know it or anything.
On a conscious level.
Yes.
So, thank you for that great story. You know, those of you who know about the constellation work, there's some strange stuff that happens when you make connection or intend to make connection or make connection on a psychic level anyway. I'm sure Peter Nelson will have something to say about that. Okay, so for next, Michael.
I would say that it's our natural state to be in this flow of connection. And it's rather because of maybe being an adult and all the traffic in society, whatever, the ego, that stops us from doing it. So it's kind of sad in a way that, you know, we have to have a special exercise to, you know, to open and all that. But being open and soft and connected and all that, I think that's our natural birth.
It's certainly a way we evolve, you know, as a, you know, primate band and then a small connected family. We're accustomed. People are accustomed to working and living in groups of 20 to 30 people, is what they say, you know. And that's kind of natural. And so the irony is, as there's more and more people, we're less and less connected. And so it's kind of unnatural the way we're living. We have, instead of a 20 or 30 people, we have a whole community, we have a whole et cetera, et cetera. But how connected are people to that larger framework? Often not very connected. So it's I think a lot of the problem has to do with disconnection. And ironically, you see a simulacrum of that in how much people connect over the internet. The problem is that doesn't seem to be a fully adequate connection. And in fact, it may take away from real connection and be counterproductive. But that's a whole other thing. Okay, so for next week, your assignment is, or your suggested assignment is, gratefulness, thankfulness. And what you do in this exercise, if I give it to you, yeah, okay. Each evening, list five things, great or small, that I would write them down in a little journal, if you have it, or a little diary. You know, five things, great or small, that you're grateful or thankful for. Either things that happened that day, or just things that exist. I'm grateful for having hot water. You know, I'm grateful for eating today. Not everybody does. And when you write these five things down, take just a moment to actually feel or pretend you're feeling grateful or thankful. The pretending you're feeling part, those of you who know about metta, some people pretend for six, I have a friend that pretended for 6 months every day that she actually felt love for anybody, including herself. And she said, you know, it was the worst exercise I ever did. I'm an engineer. I'm smart. I don't believe this crap, you know. And after about 6 months, she said, you know, I actually started to feel these little intimations of love as I was doing the method thing. And another 6 months went by, and it's now my favorite exercise. It's just my heart just opens up when I do this. I don't know if we'll see Matthew Ricard or not, but he's the guy that meditates on compassion. He doesn't even have to have an object. He just opens his heart. And he's four standard deviations to the left of everybody else in terms of activation of the left hemisphere of the brain. And left hemisphere is happy. So he's the happiest guy on earth that we've ever measured. And what he does is he just opens his heart. So anyway, if you take just a moment to actually pretend or feel grateful or thankful for the things that you're listing every night, it may have some effect. If possible, list different things every day so that you get a greater and greater feel for what you're thankful or grateful for. But that's very easy exercise. It'll take you 30 seconds. It'll take you 2 minutes because you'll actually be feeling these things. So do that at least for a week and then see if you like it. You know?
Okay. It opens you up the next day to that awareness of, I need to find something to be grateful or thankful. So you're like, ooh, beautiful, ooh, natural.
Just like three good things, you start to tune into, you start to collect. I'm grateful for that. Or what's going to be my gratefulness or thankfulness for the day? So it actually just doesn't work for 2 minutes. It starts to program you to look for those things throughout your life. Robin.
So this is the going to now replace the...
We're doing a smorgasbord. or a multi-course dinner. Try this. And then you'll decide which ones you're going to use in what way in your life. I'm just introducing you to a few of these... potentially valuable exercise.
This could include things that were good that day things in general.
Yeah, it could include things that happened or things that are. Things that happened that day or just things that exist. Either one. Okay. I need to talk with Len.
Would it be good to add the why?
No. For this one, just list them. The other one, the three good things, you add the why. But for this one, you can if you want. You can do anything you like with these exercises. But in general, this exercise is just list them and feel the gratefulness and thankfulness. Okay. I want to talk to you about... I have more media than I don't know if we'll get to any of the media. I always have way too much stuff, of course. It's a three-hour class pushed into an hour and a half, and it's a 16-week class pushed into 10 weeks. But we'll do the best we can, okay? If anything, it makes me more succinct. That's good. So what I want to talk about, some of these chapters I won't have much to say about, they're pretty self-evident, but this chapter and the next chapter especially, I need to talk to you about. The next chapter, I want you to, if you read chapter 5 for next week, read it kind of critically, because he does say something that is stunningly wrong.
Wait, which chapter?
Chapter 5. But chapter 4, I do need to comment. He also says a lot of right things, but I don't think about that. Okay, so chapter 4, I kind of want to go through it a little bit and underline some things, because this is stuff that I think most of you got out of it, but I just want to reinforce, or if you didn't get out of it, I want you to hear this. And if you're not reading along with us, this hopefully will be somewhat self-explanatory. Okay, so if you do want to page along... first thing is on page 45, and I need to kind of explain this a little bit. Okay, so... So those of you who are mathematically inclined realize this is not a valid equation. It's really not. But he couldn't make the complicated form of it. But what this says is enduring happiness, not moment by moment happiness, but lasting, authentic, enduring happiness, has three things that contribute to it. Your genetic set point or range, your genetic set range, that is what your genes program you for in terms of happiness, the circumstances of your life, and the voluntary things you can do to increase your happiness. The voluntary things are how you think and how you behave. So, thoughts and behaviors. Life circumstances, and genes, genetic set range. And this is enduring happiness. So it turns out that about approximately 50% of most personality traits are heritable. That is, come from genes rather than what's happened to you in your life. Of course, this is a totally false distinction, because now we know that epigenetics and your genes are being turned on and off all the time by what does happen to you in your life. So you right now are a result of what your genes are doing based on what has happened in your life. So the whole thing is a bogus argument. But anyway, about 50% of your happiness is determined by your genetics. That is, one person might have genes that predispose her to these possibilities. Here's a 10, here's a 0. So one person might have genes that predispose her here. Another person might have genes that predispose her here. It is possible for this person, based on what has happened to her, to be over here. Not so happy. And it is possible for this person, based on what's happened to her, to be over here, quite a bit happier. So the range is large, because it's 50%. So the point is that you can move, by these things, you can move yourself up and down within your range. But it is true that some people are going to be happy no matter what. And you read stories about them, they come out of horrible situations, and they say, no, it's fine, I'm good, you know. And other people are kind of not so happy no matter what. Like Len, you know, Seligman's friend who, you know, got $1 million together, but, So the bad news is that you get a genetic endowment, and you kind of tend to come back to that. Remember in the chapter, we talked about people who win the lottery, come back to where they were. People who develop quadriplegia come back almost to where they were. It turns out that the data show that it's not true that people that become crippled or otherwise severely attenuated come back to where they were. They come back to almost where they were in general, and oftentimes have to fight depression to get there. But lottery winners come back to where they were. You know, after a while, it's just another thing you're spending money on and doesn't elevate you. Okay, so really what this equation should say is we have a set range, and these factors determine where on the set range you find yourself, and that's mathematically more complicated to express. So it isn't just these things sum up. Anyway, the question is, how can you come to the top of your set range for happiness as opposed to being in the middle of it or sinking to the bottom of it? And there are two ways you can do that. You can do that by changing your life circumstances, or you can do that by changing how you think and behave. And what everybody out there thinks is, if I change my life circumstances, it's going to make a difference for me. If I get richer, if I get a good relationship, if I have better health, if I'm beautiful, if I live in California, I'm going to be a lot happier. And that's the story we tell ourselves. That's the remembering self, in Dan Kahneman's words. That's the story we tell ourselves. You ask people from Ohio, are you happier in California? They say, oh, absolutely, totally happier. But you give them a beeper, and you give them there's no beepers anymore. You give them a smartphone, and every hour you ask them what they're doing, who they're doing it with, how they feel, and you find out that they were just the same in California as they are in Ohio. Doesn't make any difference. Okay, it's not a factor that makes a difference. So the big misapprehension is that life circumstances will change how happy you are. It's wrong. It's why government policies around the world are typically wrong. They want to make people richer. If they make people richer, they think people will be happier. Yes, it's true. You want to eliminate poverty because poor people are not so happy. But once you get people to a reasonable comfort level, then making everybody richer does not make them happier. There should be another set of national priorities that have to do with focusing on what actually does make people happier. And that's what I may get to show you today. If not, there's a guy named Ed Diener, D-I-E-N-E-R, who works with world governments on this, and you can look on YouTube and see some of the talks he has given about what really does make people happy in different societies. Anyhow, life circumstances account for 10%. Not a lot. Okay? There are certain life circumstances that are way more heavily than others, but when we go through the chapter, I'll talk about the ones that do and don't weigh at all. So that leaves about 40% for how you think and how you behave. So most of the deal of what you can change is your internal workings rather than the external workings. Another way to say this is, don't bother rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. Get another boat. Change who you are, not the traffic around you. Okay, so that's the basic thrust of the chapter is people misunderstand what is going to make them happy, and they focus too much on life circumstances.
Plus, add in advertising, media, and all those messages. I mean, they totally play on, buy this, you'll be happy.
You know, as of about 7 or 8 years ago when I had the data, the average American teenager, by the time she or he is 18, sees 500,000 television commercials, and every single one of them has exactly the same subtext. Buy this and you'll be happy. Get this, they have all these happy people holding the, get this and you'll be happy. So people think that if they're not happy, they gotta go shopping, and if they didn't get happy enough when they went shopping, they gotta get something better, and it drives the engine of commerce, but it doesn't drive people to happiness. In fact, it drives them to poverty. But okay, so wait. Let me read the quote about this. Materialism. This is from Seligman. Materialism seems to be counterproductive.
What page?
That doesn't matter. It's a short quote. At all levels of real income, people who value money more than other goals are less satisfied with their income and with their lives as a whole. Okay. That is, well, it was kind of tangential. I shouldn't have actually mentioned that there. But the point is that people that value money and possessions actually are less satisfied no matter how many money and possessions they have. So, before we go into the chapter, I got to tell you that there has been a revision of this. In Seligman's 2011 book, Flourish, which has its good parts, it has its kind of pedantic and boring parts. So I don't recommend it, but it won't hurt you to read it. If you take antidepressant medication, it might hurt you to read it, though. Because it basically says placebo. Seligman's new proposal for a formula such as it is this. It's allied to this, but I want to just write it down for you to see it. He says, we ought to be talking about happiness, we ought to be talking about well-being. Because happiness means smiling. Well-being means just being better. And so it's a broader concept. Happiness is too fuzzy a concept and too narrow a concept. He said there are 5 factors involved. One is positive emotion, what we normally mean by happiness in the culture. Second is engagement, which we're going to... Okay, so the 3 of these are what we're going to talk about in this class from the book. Positive emotion, which is what we are starting to read about in the next 3 chapters. We're going to be reading about how you increase positive emotion by these factors. Okay, how these factors, your thoughts and behaviors, can help you have more positive emotion. Then we're going to go into reading about engagement, how being engaged in life, what you're doing and the people around you, is a more powerful factor for happiness. And then finally, at the end of the book, we're going to be talking about how what you're engaged in is meaningful, if it's beyond yourself, if it connects to a larger set of principles or a larger group of people, that is the most powerful factor for happiness. So these 3 things are where we're going in terms of the book, but they add, and we're not calling it happiness, now we're calling it well-being, but there are 2 more factors. relationship is so important that it gets broken out into its own factor. Relationship just seems to be, people who are isolated just do not do as well. People with strong relationships just do better. So relationship is another primary factor in how happy you are. And this one, which arose late in positive psychology's thinking. A stands for accomplishment or achievement. It turns out that we do things which really make us quite satisfied that do not bring us more material reward, don't bring us more approbation in any way. We just do them because we want to do them. I'm going to get to the top of that hill if it kills me. It's not because you're getting paid to get to the top of the hill. It's because when you get up there, you think, yes, I got to the top of the hill. There's something incredibly satisfying about deciding you're going to learn Spanish and then doing it every day, going on Duolingo and doing it, you know, and nobody's paying you for it. Nobody's, you know, appreciating it. But you, as you learn Spanish, you just think, I can talk to half the people in Santa Barbara. It makes sense. It's so good. You know, so why do we have this program of wanting to, you can give chimpanzees a little kind of physical puzzle, and they will sit there for hours and hours and hours until they solve that puzzle. Not because you pay them or in any way, just because they have to solve the puzzle. Turns out that this is a powerful motive for why we do what we do, and the question is why? Why does it make any difference to achieve something if you're not recognized for it? If you're not paid for it, if it doesn't give you food or shelter? Well, think about, if we go to evolutionary psychology again, why would it be a good idea for a creature to be able to master its environment, learn stuff about its environment, do stuff in its environment? Well, the creature that knows more and that can do more is more likely to survive in times of threat or opportunity, right? The more you know, the more you can do, the more you can pull upon to deal with the world. So we have this accomplishment motive because when we do something, it makes us feel we're better able to deal, to survive and procreate, to deal with the world. So accomplishment is deep in us as a motive because it indicates to us that we are equal to life. We can do this. We can do life. So this one turns out to be a powerful factor. So having given all that preamble, let's quickly go through this. On page
46 is a general happiness scale, which some of you took. And the average for Americans from 1 to 70 is 4.8, about 5. If you didn't score 5, you might say to yourself, does that mean I'm less happy than the average American? And if you say, you know, 5 on a scale of 7, when I look around me, I don't know that everybody's a 5 on a scale of 7, it's because this is a self-report measure. We talked about this. When people are asked to give a report of how well or happy they are, they don't want to give you an impression that is not okay. And even if they do it anonymously, they want to tell themselves they're not okay. So people tend to inflate their answers. Some people are more critically honest and other people are more like, five. So you have to take all self-report measures with a mountain of salt. I generally subtract on a 7-point scale 1 point for social desirability and self-esteem. So typically, I think when I read 4.8, I think 3.8, or I think about 4. That seems about right. Seems like probably the middle of the scale is where people generally are, and they say I'm happier than normal, or I'm unhappier than normal, and that would seem to be a self-adjusting scale, so you're kind of more in the middle. Anyway, when you do some of these questionnaires, look at two things first. Do you believe the norms? You know, is it self-reported? Do we have to adjust the norms? And secondly, look at the sample. This particular one, we don't have a good
estimation for the sale, where they got the number 4.8. But let's say a lot of people, and it's probably a good representative sample of the United States, but some of the other ones are going to be very peculiar samples. And when you compare yourself to those other people, you're going to say, well, I didn't do as well. Look at who they're comparing you to.
The happiness thermostat, you know, that to your genetic setting. The hedonic treadmill, that's kind of a cheap way to say that my circumstances, that we adapt to them. I'm here on the happiness thing. Get a new car, way up here, it's such a cool car, and you know, every day it's kind of cool, but it's a little less cool than whatever. And pretty soon I'm back down here, and I think, well, I need a new house. And that's what keeps the engine of commerce running, but it can't keep you running, but it keeps you running in the same place. So that's another way to say that, that life circumstances have a tendency to wear off, not all of them. It doesn't say in this book, but there are two life circumstances that people don't seem to recover from completely. Well, there's a bunch of them, but several of them I'll mention is unemployment for men. Even years later, there's some lowering of the general happiness because that happened. Divorce for women. There seems to be some sort of lowering of the happiness that persists at least at some level. For both sexes, losing a spouse or a child seems to have an enduring effect. But for most everything else, we think it's going to last for a lifetime, but we do recover. We come back to that genetic let's see. Money. We talked about money, or that list that was in the book about which countries are happier or unhappier. That's what I want to focus on, so I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to go into that in some detail, and I'll probably do that again using the media in a couple of weeks. That's an important question. So it turns out that within a country, once the country, you know, unless it, within a country, very rich people aren't happier than just okay people. Poor people are less happy. But within a country, pretty much the happiness level is determined by the prosperity of the country. However, between countries, there are huge differences in how happy people are. Because of the political structure, also of the economic structure. That's what we're going to look at now. Robert.
Yeah, I've questioned the purchasing power because some of these countries have a huge social support system, and I wonder if it's including that.
Forget this chart. I'm going to go to a better set of data. Okay, so skipping that for a minute, marriage. So should you get married to be happier? Not necessarily. We only know that there's a correlation between marriage and happiness. Married people report more happiness than any other category of not connected people or formerly connected people. But the question is whether marriage causes happiness or whether happiness causes marriage. Whether if you're happier to do it, you're more likely to get married because you're more optimistic and also because you're more attractive, or maybe some third factor causes both of them. Maybe being beautiful causes you to be happy and get married, or maybe being well off, or whatever factors might be behind this correlation. So we only know that marriage and happiness are strongly correlated, but we don't know if marriage causes it. You know one thing, by the way, unhappy marriages are worse than no marriages in terms of depressing. Again, social life, we have the same correlation. That is, people with a more social life, spend the least time alone, have the most significant connections, are clearly happier than people with less social life, less significant connections. But the question is, does the social life cause happiness? Or are happier people more likely to make friends, because they're easy to make friends with and be social? Or is there some third factor like genetics? You have good genes, you're probably happier because you're your mind and body are functioning well. And you, because you're happier, you know, you might also be, because you have good genes, you might also be more attractive to other people. So it may be a third factor causing the link. But again, correlations are not causations. What we need to do is we need to take two groups of people and take one group of people and say, for the next 5 years, if you have any friends, you guys have a lot of friends, I'm going to see what happens.
How does charity work fit into all this?
That's a later question, but the short answer to that is people who do volunteer work for good causes are helped in two ways. First, because just doing something like that makes your life more meaningful and so it boosts your happiness. And also because it brings you into connection with other people, and that connection with other people boosts your happiness. So doing any kind of volunteer work or charity work really seems to be a good strategy. Okay, negative emotion. It turns out that half of the human race is more bummed out than the other half. And that half happens to be female. That is, females clearly have more depression than males, have more negative affect, One half of the human race is clearly happier than the other half of the human race. That half of the human race tends to be female, is female. That is, females also have more positive feelings and more strong positive feelings. Women, at least according to these surveys, have both more negative and more positive feeling. They have a higher amplitude of feeling. Now, that could be one of two reasons. It could be because women are physiologically different than men. It could also be because men don't admit of feelings or are out of touch with feelings they actually have. So I don't necessarily trust that finding in terms of being true, just in terms of what people self-report as true. Let's see. Age. Here's one that's interesting for many of us. It is not true that older people are less happy than younger people. That's fiction. Life satisfaction goes up slightly with age. Positive affect, pleasant affect, declines slightly. So life satisfaction goes up, but the amount of time you say I'm having pleasant feelings declines slightly. Negative affect doesn't change. Young people and older people report the same amount of not being okay, not feeling well, not feeling happy. What does change is the intensity of emotion. Older people tend to feel less intense emotions, both up and down. They tend to be more steady. But that's what he said in the book. You know, I got to add something to this, which is I think there's something we're all missing. I think that older people have a different kind of emotional life than younger people. Younger people have pop song emotions. You want them to go down, it's a tragedy, it's a comedy, it's all over the place. And older people have Beethoven's Fifth Symphony emotions. They're much deeper emotions. They last a lot longer. They include a lot more. They're just more powerful. They're less labile, but have more depth and power to them. So I think a conscious person who's mature is living an emotional life that is of a different kind. It's like the ocean versus the pond. And so many of you probably agree with that, and that's not something I've heard talked about in the literature. So that part didn't get in there. Michael?
There's a new song out, very popular, where it's a guy singing it, and he's expressing this pleasant affect, where he's talking to a woman, could be a guy. He's saying, I'm so taken by you, I can't feel my face. I'm still puzzling over, is this some sort of drug lingo, like heroin, or it's gone beyond me. Am I old now? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what you get the book of being high from falling in love, and everything else falls away. It's like an obsession, it's like an addiction. We're actually going to see that when we probably see Helen Fisher talk about what happens in the brain when you fall in love, etc. I don't know if we'll be able to see Helen this time or not, but the point is that people who are really in love, they kind of don't eat. The only thing that's wondering why is that it fits to that person. You know, it's just like a major addiction. And so probably I can't even feel his face, all I can feel is how he feels. Okay, health. This is the one that was the most puzzling to me in the chapter, where Seligman says health doesn't matter for happiness, objective health. He says subjective health matters. I don't know about you, but you know, when I'm not okay, I'm not okay. When I'm not okay physically, I'm subjectively not okay. They're pretty highly correlated for me. So the point is, health does matter. It's not objectively how healthy you are, it's how healthy you feel you are. So it's your internal representation of how healthy you are that clearly has a strong effect on your happiness. But what he's saying is, people sometimes with very bad stuff wrong with them feel that they're okay. And that factor doesn't impact their happiness because they don't, it's not subjectively, it's not damaging their self-image.
But it also gives you a good perspective of, like, when they say, what's the pain from 1 to 10? I mean, if you haven't hit the ground at 30-some miles an hour and slid on your face, pain is very different than, you know, if you have a headache or something. So it can really, when your health is not there, you give a brand new perspective for being
walking. Okay, so I kind of don't want to, Peggy's saying that health is a kind of complicated topic, and I kind of don't want to go in that direction, okay? Okay, I want to go quickly through each because I want to read you something, because I want to talk about countries that are happy and not so happy, and why. Okay. Education, climate, race, and gender. Turns out that education has little or no impact on lasting happiness. It does have an impact on income, which has an effect on happiness. But education by itself doesn't. I always tell my students, what are you doing here? It might have a small correlation with happiness, but not any appreciable one. Climate doesn't either. We think it does, but it doesn't. You are you wherever you are. You know, wherever you go, there you are. That's what John Kevin says. Race doesn't seem to, minority or majority doesn't seem to have any impact on happiness directly. Well, that's a puzzling finding. I guess because it's not a huge factor. Even though one is discriminated against, there are other things that indicate that. And gender doesn't have any, there's no difference between men and women in terms of enduring happiness. But there is a difference in the amplitude of the emotions. Religion does have a big difference, and spirituality is included in that. The question is why? It's possible that it's because religion and spirituality bring you into contact with other people, and that's what brings the happiness factor. It might also be, as Seligman argues, that it's the optimism that religion or spirituality brings that brings more happiness, a feeling of that there is a meaning to things, that there is a course of life, that it doesn't end with the end of life. Those things tend to be happiness boosters for obvious reasons. Okay, so now I want to talk to you about why Northern Europeans are the happiest people on Earth. Now, I'm going to, in future weeks, I'm going to modify this. How many of you have seen Nick Marx's TED Talk? A few of you from this class. I will show that to you because he's going to countervail this to some extent. But I want to read this article, which was in the Denver Post on April 25th of this year. So it's the latest Columbia survey. Since 2012, the economists at Columbia, led by Jeffrey Sachs, have been doing a world survey about who's happy. And what they find is the following. Switzerland, Iceland, Denmark, and Norway are the world's happiest countries, according to the 2015 World Happiness Report, which is put out by some influential economists. So Switzerland, Iceland, Denmark, and Norway. I'm actually going to read you the list from 2012, which is more inclusive list, so let me read this first. Three out of these European states are not members of the European Union. What are they doing right that the rest of the world and the rest of the world is doing wrong? Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, Richard Layard of the London School of Economics, and John Hallowell of the University of British Columbia have been putting out these reports since 2012. They are intended to remind governments that success is about more than economic growth and other such statistics. Sure, people are happier when they're richer and healthier,
as they tend to be in more developed countries, but there are other contributors to the perception of well-being. Is this a new level for you?
Yeah.
Okay. People in various countries are asked how they perceive the various aspects of their lives. The report's authors say six variables account for three quarters of the differences in happiness levels amongst countries. So what are these six factors? Gross domestic product per capita, that is how rich a country is. Social support. Healthy life expectancy. Freedom to make life choices. It's called autonomy. Generosity. And freedom from corruption. Two of these, social support and generosity, are relatively independent of economic development and or the political system, which explains why some relatively poor, institutionally weak countries have happier populations than the strongest Western democracies. For example, Mexicans are happier than Americans. Brazilians enjoy higher perceived well-being than the residents of rich, free Luxembourg. And Venezuelans like their life better than very rich Singaporeans. A country is an all-around winner, however, when it's rich, healthy, free, and populated with generous people who support one another when there's trouble. One has to wonder if Northern Europe's law of J-A-N-T-E, I don't know how you pronounce it, law of J-A-N-T-E, anybody know? It's in a Scandinavian country?
Janta.
Thank you, there. So, Northern European's law of Janta, might not be responsible for the presence of Iceland, Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. Iceland, Denmark, Norway, Finland, and Sweden, amongst the world's 10 happiest countries. Scandinavians may scoff at that creed, which makes individualism a crime, but it does make for unusually strong social support networks. That's how the authors explain Iceland's surprising resilience during an economic collapse, and its second place in the rankings. That country has the highest percentage in the world of people who say they have someone to count on in times of crisis.
So,
let me now read to you from the 2012 World Happiness Index. This is the Columbia University one. Again, there are other indexes. There's the Gallup World Poll, one that Mark Snedeker. This is just one such credible index. Okay, so the 40 happiest places on Earth, I'll just read you the top 20, okay? This is in 2012. First is Denmark. Second is Finland. Third, Norway. Fourth, the Netherlands. Northern Europe. Fifth, Canada. Sixth, Switzerland. Seventh, Sweden. Eighth, New Zealand. Ninth, Australia. Tenth, Ireland. And you all know about that, never mind. Ireland is not that well off by the rankings, but it does very well. 11th, United States. 12th, Costa Rica. 13th, Austria. 14th, Israel. 15th, Belgium. 16th, Luxembourg. 17th, United Arab Emirates. 18th, United Kingdom. 19th, Venezuela. 20th, Iceland. I'm going to read you some other statistics in a minute, but if you remember the chart in Authentic Happiness, there are some anomalies around the world in general I want to talk to you about. Northern Europe and North America are, and Australia, New Zealand, and a couple of countries in South America are the happiest places on Earth. And Saudi Arabia is quite happy too, which is quite well to do. Other countries less so. Certain countries are happier than their economy would predict dramatically, and those are Latin and South American countries, whose economies are not very good, but whose happiness is quite high. And there are certain, the answer to the question is, why is that? And various people give various answers, but frequently the answer that's given is family structure is more intact in those countries, and there's an ethic in those countries of enjoying life more and being less materially focused. And so quite a few Latin and South American countries that rank way higher in happiness than their economies would predict. The unhappiest places on Earth seem to be in Eastern Europe, and especially in Sub-Saharan Africa, where the conditions are really abysmal and happiness levels, well, I'll tell you in a minute what the happiness levels are. The Asian nations are kind of a puzzle. Economically, they're very well off. Their happiness levels are quite lower than you would expect. Japan especially stands out for having one of the highest economic levels, and the happiness is in the middle of the pack at best. So the question is why that is in the Asian nations, and maybe that people are less willing to say that they're happy because it's not the norm. You're supposed to be those collectivist societies, and the idea is you don't want to kind of stand out, you want to kind of be modest. But there also seems to be an actual effect, not just a self-reporting effect. And I've heard that in Japan that might have something to do with the pressures to achieve and the amount of work that is demanded. In terms of the happiness differences around the world, I don't need to show you this at least today, but Ed Diener does a lot of work with this. The Gallup World Poll goes to all the countries of the world and does and knocks on doors, so it's a representative sample, so it really is an accurate deal for every country. Turns out that countries like Denmark and Switzerland are about 8 on a scale of 10. If you ask the average person, how happy are you? The average person says 7 or 8 or 9. About 8 is what they average. If you go to Togo, Sierra Leone, Chad, Zimbabwe, you go to those countries and you ask, how happy are you? The ratings are in the 3s or low 4s. So, what he showed, what Peter showed is the unhappiest person in Denmark is as happy as the happiest person in Togo. Also, life expectancy in places around the world is kind of dramatically different. In places like Japan, it's 82. The United States is like 79 something. You know, typically about 80 for the prosperous countries. The life expectancy in Burundi is 36 years. I mean, so there's huge differences. So, Niener says, why is this? Why are the factors that make overall populations healthy and happy and unhealthy and unhappy? And he says a lot of it has to do with corruption and being able to trust your neighbor. He said in some countries, they ask them if you lost your wallet, would the police return it? And the people say no. And they ask the people if you lost your wallet, would your neighbor return it? And they say no. So in countries where you can't trust anybody, it's really hard to keep a smile on your face. Countries that do well are countries that where people can make their own decisions, where they have enough resources, where they can kind of pull their own strings, and where they can trust the social structure. Also, the two things I want to underline are countries which have strong social support systems. That is, they take care of people both formally and informally. They have healthcare systems that actually work for everybody, not just a couple. They guarantee education, they take care of old people. Those are countries that are going to be happier no matter what their levels become. Also, countries where people are more generous are countries that are going to be happier. So, in the last 5 minutes or so, let's see what you have to say, and then I want to read you a couple more funny statistics. Not so funny statistics. But let's see if there's a comment or two right now. Anything you want to say about this?
Michael,
it's just a question. I've heard that there are a lot of Swedes at Santa Barbara City College, and a lot of the ones I've met are really happy, and they don't look so bad either. I was just curious, you're teaching there, do you feel they're really happy?
It's changed a little bit. Now I actually have the Swedish students get these. But when I, as of 5 or 7 years ago, of the Swedish students that I have, not one didn't get an A. So I don't know if they're selected to come over here because they're so good, but they were always amazingly good students, also remarkably good looking, and happy and healthy, and what I know, especially notice is more mature. If I have a bunch of Swedish students in my class, I make the class more stable and more mature. So, but I don't know if that's because they're older, because they're like 3 years older coming over here. I just know that it makes the instructors at City College happy to have so many Swedish students. But again, there might be a selection factor there. They probably don't send the worst students over. I know that the government pays for them to come over. Okay, there's one more hand out of comments. So Pencil A and then.
I think we're a skewed distribution here, so we have to work harder. When I was a social worker at a hospital, I had so many interactions every 5 minutes. And now, if you're home alone with a lot of books, you have to work at all of those points. Where before, a lot of them you were just plugged into automatically.
Okay, so you have to read. So you have to plug in if your life circumstances are such that you become peripheralized. And you do that by coming to classes, you do that by volunteering, you get into social structures, because even though it's a pain to have to get dressed and get out of the house, it works. Yeah. Yeah.
Also, we tend to be painted who we are right now by the rest of society. And we don't have recognition for our whole life and all the experiences. They just see us in green.
Yeah, in our culture, age is not appreciated, it's marginalized.
Well, when I was taking classes at City College, particularly with the Finnish students, they seemed to be more rounded, and I found that in their countries, men and women competed on the same teams. So they were basketball. All the basketball teams were required to have females, and it wasn't one or two. So they knew how to interact across the sex line in normal settings. The other thing, there was nothing about the government paying for them to get here. They were actually working a year or two to amass the money to come. So there was, and they wanted to make the best of what they were doing when they were here because it was out of their pocket. They were outgoing, they were positive, they were fully engaged in their lives. And there was, and they played too. They tended to be the better students too.
Yeah, so that confirms what I noticed. Okay, so I'm gonna give you two more statistics here just because it's fascinating. Okay.
Okay, and this is from the 2012 Columbia World Happiness Survey. To give lie to the fact that money buys happiness, the richest country on earth is in terms of per capita GDP, with a per capita GDP in 2012 of $104,000 a person. Is Qatar, Q-A-T-A-R, and it ranks 31st in happiness. The second highest GDP is Luxembourg, $81,000 per person, 16th in happiness. Third in 2012 was Singapore at $60,500, and that ranks 33rd in happiness. Norway is the fourth richest country in the world, $54,200 a person, and that ranks third in happiness. The fifth richest country in the world, in terms of per capita GDP, $49,800, is Hong Kong, and it ranks 67th in happiness. Life expectancy,
Japan is almost 84 years.
But that doesn't say how the wealth is distributed.
No, it doesn't say how the wealth is
distributed. Very important.
Right.
Very important.
Of course, of course. Yeah. If they're...
Yes, but
yeah, for multiple reasons, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, life, just for a couple more, life expectancy in Japan is 84 years, 83.91 years, and it's 44th in happiness. Singapore has an 83.75 year life expectancy, it's 33rd in happiness. Hong Kong has an 82 year life expectancy, it's 67th in happiness. Australia has an 82-year life expectancy, it's ninth. And Italy has an 81.86-year life expectancy, and it's 28th in happiness. Last statistic for today. Fewest murders per million people. The United States is not on this list. Okay, Hong Kong has 2 murders per million people, and it ranks 67th in happiness. Go figure. Singapore has 3 murders per million people and ranks 33rd in happiness. Iceland has 3 and ranks 20th in the survey in happiness. Japan has 4 murders per million people and ranks 44th. And Norway has 6 murders per million people and ranks 3rd. If you want to see the rest of these statistics, come up right after class and I will
I'll put it up here so you can see.
Paul.
And that's why I was surprised when you said Finland, they were happy there, because when I lived in Europe, you always knew that the Finnish were depressed and high suicide rate.
Yeah. The countries that have light difficulties in the winter, there tends to be more alcoholism and more depression at those points, and in cities in the United States where that's the case also.
I'll just use my voice, is that when you first come to America, it's so shocking how happy everyone looks. It's really nice. When you come from London, and I was staying with some genetic scientists in San Francisco, and I went out for a walk, it was just before Christmas, and people were saying hello to me, like Americans do. They said, hi. And I said, what are these people saying hello? And I said, yeah, they do that here. Just say hello back. And I said even to men, because a woman, if a man says hello in my country, you don't say hello to me unless you come across me. And they said, no, just say hello, it's fine, this is America, everyone's very friendly.
That's the most frequent comment I get from my Swedish students is when we go around and talk about social norms, they say, oh my God, people talk to you here. They say hello to you. What a front that would be to us.
You also hug a person without them asking you to. And I've lived here since 1988 and I still am not used to somebody I don't know. I say, okay, you can hug me, I'm not a woman.
So my question is whether these social norms, whether they translate into actual happiness or whether they're social conventions. For example, everybody in the United States says, how are you? They say, I'm fine. You're supposed to wear a smile on your face. But whether that's really the way that you're feeling or not is somewhat questionable. By the way, I do want to make underline what Catherine said, which I think further research is going to show that climate does make some difference, and that certainly we already know that sunlight does, or lack of sunlight depresses people. We don't know that more sunlight makes people happier, but we are going to find out, I think, with finer grain research, that climate does have some greater effect.
Yeah, but how do you account for Iceland? That's also cold in the north, but they're definitely
I've been
there.
I was in Iceland, and they're the most amazingly, what a wonderful place. But I was there in the wintertime when they drink. These are in the summertime, they're out riding their ponies and hiking around.
They drink and they love, because they have a different concept of that kind of that part of the sexuality and sharing partners and looking after the children. They're completely different. They have often had children with a lot of different men or women, and they all look after the children. It's very different.
Which is the way that we have evolved.
And that was needed in the time when there wasn't much food and people's help. So it's a very interesting.
Yeah, it was a fascinating place. I recommend a nice little hike like this summer. Read chapter 5 for next week and read it with a critical eye. Okay?